wonderful woman that I have come to respect a great deal and know. Her name is Carolyn Meese. And she has a tape that I heard a few years ago called Why People Don't Heal, I believe it is. And the central theme of her tape, when I heard that tape, I was just fascinated by it. In fact, it was the only time in my entire professional life that I went out of my way to call somebody who was just beginning on this path and to offer an endorsement. Now, I get requests for hundreds of endorsements every week for something, most of which I am unable to do. But in this case, I was so taken by the profound wisdom of what and how she presented it that I called and left a message with her that if she would like my endorsement, if she's interested in that, I'd be happy to give it. And she did. And what she said is that the reason that people don't heal in their life is because they are bonded to the wounds of their past. They not only have understood them and practiced them and perhaps even embraced them and understood them, but they have now bonded to them. And they use these wounds as a rationale for why their life isn't working the way they would like it to work today. And they continually haul out all of these terrible things that happened. And within 5 minutes of meeting them, you'll know that they're an alcoholic, or that they were sexually abused, or that their father walked out on them, or that they lived in an orphanage, or that they were very poor, or that they suffer from depression, or whatever it might be. And the constant using of these wounds of the past as almost like a calling card is what keeps them back there. When I suggest to you that you don't have to have a personal history, I'm not saying that you have to give up everything and everyone that ever happened to you, and you have to forget about it and not have traditions. I'm suggesting that you take this very, very seriously, that the reason why your life is going the way it is going is because of the choices that you are making today, right now, in your life. And that anything else that you are using that is back here in the wake as a rationale or an explanation for why your life isn't going the way you would like it to go is nothing more than an excuse to which you will bond yourself, and as a result of that bonding, you will keep yourself back living in those obstacles rather than creating an intention of what you want to have for yourself in your life. And it's a very common thing to do. And on the extra mile, you'll find people. I remember Castaneda's teacher telling him, you'll know when you are free from your personal history, because he said, if you don't have a story, you don't have to live up to it. Which is pretty good. You just don't have to live up to your story. He said the way that you will know that you are free from this is that you should check yourself into the seediest motel that you can possibly find, with cockroaches in it and with the paint that is chipped off the walls, and the most unpleasant kind of place that you can check yourself into, and don't tell anyone that you're there. And you stay in that room and don't come out until it makes no difference to anyone whether you do or you don't. How's that for a test? Until you get free from this idea of what somebody else might think or what might say or might begin to use on you. And most of this stuff that is in our past is all related to our families. My mother, my father, my siblings, my in-laws, whatever. There's a wonderful line that I really love. And in fact, I've been thinking about writing a book with this as the title. Your friends are God's way of apologizing for your relatives. What do you think? Is that a good title? Huh? And I'd suggest that you look at all of the things that you have allowed in your past to be the reasons why, particularly in your relationships with your family, and just say to yourself, I no longer have a personal history. You know? I am not attached to any of that at all. I look upon my personal history, and I have for a long time, as one of the great advantages of my life. Because I feel that when we come here, we have a heroic mission, and that it was my dharma, my destiny, my path, if you will, to teach self-reliance. I've never done anything else since I was a little boy. And my entire professional life and all of my teaching and all of the work that I've done, all of the books have all been directed towards just teaching people about self-reliance. And it's almost as if God said, if you really want to teach self-reliance, then you'll have to get your little ass into an orphanage. And spend a few years there learning to rely upon yourself. And once you learn how to do that, once you have that experience of how to do that, then you'll never use it as an excuse or a rationale or a reason why you can't get something done yourself. You don't have to blame anybody else. You'll know to rely upon yourself, and it won't be because of something that you learned in a book or that you heard on a tape. It'll be because you have made conscious contact with self-reliance. And you had to have it, and you had to do it. And the people that I have had the greatest amount of respect and admiration for over the years are the people who have been through it, understood it, written about it, or told other people about it, and let it go, and moved on in their life. And if you can't do that, if you're still wallowing around back there in your personal history, well, I like to make a distinction between the things in our lives that we call struggles or difficulties, we'll just call them struggles, and facts. Our struggles and facts, the facts of life. Now, a fact is that I am 6'1". The fact is that I am 61 years of age. Fact is that I weigh 185 pounds. Fact is all of the things that are unchangeable about my life are facts. Fact is that my hairline has receded slightly since I was a little boy, all the way to the back of my neck. These are the facts. Now, if any one of you were to tell me tomorrow, I would like you to come to this lecture hall, and I would like you to be 5'4". And I'd like you to be 30 years of age. And I'd like you to have a full head of hair, please. All right. You would say, well, you can't do that because the facts are such and you can't do anything about the facts. Most of you would agree that you can't be a different age or different height, a different sex, and so on than you are right now. Is that correct? These are the facts of your life. And there's lots of those facts, lots of them. How much is in your bank book, what kind of work you do, what kind of education you've had in your life, and so on. These are all facts. Now, the problems or the struggles that you face in your life are something very different. These are the result of how you interpret things and so on. You understand that you can do something about the struggles and about the problems and about the things that you face in your life. That you can do something about. You can change the way you think, the way you process things. You can move. You can change relationships. There's a lot of things that you can do. You can go back to school. You can learn a new trade. There's endless numbers of things you can do about the problems, the struggles that you face in your life. We can do lots of things about that. But you can't do anything about the facts, the real facts. And there aren't too many. But the biggest fact of your life that you can do absolutely nothing about is your past. And most people spend about 80% of their mental energy on trying to change or being upset about the facts. And that's what I'd like you to take a look at when I say give up your personal history. It's a fact. You had these parents. I've often told the story of my daughter, Serena, who I have had a few interchanges with over the years. She's always been the one who has been very willing to let me know when I'm not doing things the way she thinks that I should do them. And I remember one day finally just reaching the end of the line with her and saying something out loud like, "You know, I'm really tired of you telling me what kind of a parent I should be and what I'm doing wrong," because she was really good at that. And instead, what I'd like to do is have you start taking responsibility for the kind of parent I've become. She said, you want to run that one by me one more time? You want me to be responsible for the kind of parent? I said, yeah, absolutely. I said, I am who I am. These are the facts of who I am and what I've been, and I can't change them. These are the facts. And the fact is that you chose me to be your father. And if you didn't want me to be your father, you should have chosen someone else. I got her attention. She was about 11. She said, "Hold it." And she did it just like that. "Hold it there. Hold it. You're telling me that I chose you? I don't know what you're talking about." I said, "Well, I said, before you came into this world, I said, you have certain things that you have to accomplish here on this planet. And all of us have certain things that we have to do. And we need parents in order to get through. So you decided that mom would be your mother and that I would be your father." She said, "I don't have any memory of any of this at all." I said, "Well, your memory is not a good indicator of whether what I'm saying is true or not. Of course you don't have any memory of it. You don't even remember living in a crib. You don't remember what you had for breakfast last Thursday. You don't remember being in mom's tummy. You don't remember being born. You don't remember, there's most of the things of your life you have no memory of. Your memory is not a good indicator. We can't use your memory." I said, "You got to trust me on this. You chose me to be your father. You chose mom to be your mother." She said, "Well, when do you think this took place?" She got really intrigued by this. I said, "Well, it took place before you decided to come here." She said, "So you're telling me that I actually picked you to be my father?" I said, "Exactly." And she gave me the greatest line. She said, "I must have been in a hurry." You could never go one up on Serena, all right? I was just sort of semi-kidding with her, but there is a part of me that really believes that we did have to pick certain people. I mean, the most influential person in my life, probably the person who turned my life from a life that was headed towards anonymity, a life that was... I was overweight, I was drinking, I was playing around with drugs, I was, my writing was going nowhere. I wanted to write, but I just couldn't. I was in relationships that just didn't match and didn't work out. I was always trying to get someplace else. I ate horrible, greasy, what I call greasy cheeseburgers, three of them with shiny buns. I always remember. I always remember the term shiny buns, because if the grease wasn't on the buns enough and they weren't shiny enough, I'd send them back. I mean, I would eating that kind of stuff and drinking soda pop and drinking alcohol and so many things in my life were headed down a path that was not going to materialize into the destiny, the heroic mission that all of us have and that I showed up here for. And this man that was the most influential person in my life was a man that I grew up hating, that I never saw in my life, who walked out on my life when I was just a child, never even when I was just an infant, never made a phone call, never even acknowledged that he had a son named Wayne. This was my father. And it wasn't until much, much later in my life, when I was in my 30s, just before I wrote Your Erroneous Zones, that I was able to go to his grave and have an act of forgiveness. And when I had that act of forgiveness and I let go of all of this stuff that I had just carried around with me for so many years, I walked away from it. I sent away the anger and the hatred and the bitterness and I started sending this person love who was now dead. And I walked away from that experience. I've written about it. I've talked about it on other tapes. I've wrote about it, and you'll see it when you believe it. But I walked away from that experience in 1974, and I went and I checked into a motel, a seedy one, with cockroaches, in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. And I wrote a book called Your Erroneous Zones in 14 days, beginning to end. And it became the catalyst, the turning point in my life. I began to give up the sedentary lifestyle, the couch potato lifestyle. I began running and becoming active. I began to attract into my life more profound ideas and people in my life. Everything just seemed to turn around because I gave up my personal history. I gave up the idea that I was feeling sorry for myself for being an orphan, or for living in foster homes, or for not having a father. I gave it all up and realized that that was a choice that I made perhaps unconsciously, perhaps even before I ever showed up. Who knows? But who's to question it? How can you question the facts? I don't go around and say, you know, I was born in 1940. I should have been born in 1460. I mean, you don't go around saying that. You say, the fact of my life, I showed up on the 10th of May. In 1940. That's the day I showed up. And I was conceived sometime in September of 1939. That's a fact. And you don't change the facts. And by giving up our personal history, what we do is we give up our attachment to the past and our bonding to our wounds. And we merge into something much more powerful, into this thing called the now. And the now is easy to talk about, but difficult for most people to be in, and yet it's the only place you can ever be. Every moment that you have of guilt in your life about what could have happened, what should have happened, takes place in the now. So people have often said, well, guilt is just a way of living in the past. There is no possibility of living in the past. It's an illusion of the ego. You can't live in the past. What you do is you use up your present being immobilized over what took place in the past. But you're always in the present. And that's the only place that God is. Here. In this moment. And you don't worry by living in the future. There's nobody out there living in the future. You're living now. In the present, using up your moments now to be immobilized over what might or might not happen down the road. But make no mistake about it, that's all taking place now. This is all you get. Just the now. And to use up your now with this personal history, one of the great glories of giving up your personal history is you give up guilt along the way. You just give it up. And you start to look at all of these people that were in your life who did all of these things that you think they shouldn't have done. And instead of being mad at them and angry at them and using up your now with that anger and with that hatred and that bitterness, you begin to practice letting it all go. It's about understanding that people come into the world and do what they know how to do. Given the circumstances of their life, they do what they know how to do. It isn't good or bad. It isn't right or wrong. It isn't moral or immoral. It's just they're doing what they knew how to do. When I went down to Biloxi to go to my father's grave in 1974, the only thing I wanted to know on that trip was if he ever in his life acknowledged that he had a son named Wayne. That was my ego at work. I just wanted to know, did this man ever acknowledge myself and my two brothers? And I found the death certificate. It was in Biloxi, Mississippi, and it was kept in an old Coca-Cola box with rain spots on the box. And we finally went through to his death was 1964 in New Orleans and when they shipped his body there and all of that. And I pulled out the file and I went through it, and I finally found the day that he had died. They had it done by date, not even by name or by person. And I was going through this old file box. It's a cardboard box that Coca-Cola bottles had been shipped in. And I found Melvin Lyle Dyer, and I found his birth date and his death date, and I looked on down the list to see if he had any descendants. Yeah. And there were my three brothers' names, Jim, David, and Wayne. And I was like at peace. I thought, you know, this guy came into the world and he basically knew that he was a jerk. And he not only did to what he did to my mother, but he did it to five additional women and abandoned everybody and spent years of his life in prison and was an alcoholic and abusive person. And everybody, I used to think it was just my mother. I used to say, Mother, I said, there's a good side to everybody. Yeah, and she'd say, yeah, you try being married to him. You go find someone that has something good to say about him. And I met each one, I researched his life and met each one of his ex-wives. And all of them basically had the same opinion that my mother had had. And I thought to myself, he must have known at some level that his presence in my life would drag it down and in my brother's lives. Somehow, by being there, perhaps he knew that. And maybe that's why. Maybe in my own heart I needed to see something positive or something good about this person. And that's how I've always thought of him, as a person who was noble, and that he stayed away and allowed his ex-wife and his three children at least the opportunity to stay in a different energy field than the one that would have dragged us down. But that's how I see it, and I know the day that I die, and when I do come into contact with him, that I will share that. And I've shared it with him on many occasions in my own quiet, contemplative, private moments. Because finally, after a lifetime of anger and a lifetime of bitterness, I was able to give up my personal history. And I encourage every single one of you to do the same. Don't bond to your wounds. Don't see yourself as all of those labels. Kierkegaard, the famous Danish theologian Søren Kierkegaard, once said that once you label me, you negate me. And our past is filled with labels about what we can and can't do. I'm not very good at this. I'm not athletic. I'm not musical. I'm not able to do certain kinds of activities. I don't have a good memory. I'm not very good at mathematics. I've never been good at relating to other people. I'm shy. I'm nervous. I'm clumsy. These are all labels from the wake, from our past. And all of them are just things that you have used as an explanation or as an excuse for why you don't move into a different place in your life. And they all revolve around this thing called failure. I tried them. I wasn't good at them, therefore I failed. And when you give up your personal history, you give up the concept of failure. It is, again, another illusion. You have never failed at anything in your life. Everything you've ever done has produced a result. You are just out there producing results. The issue isn't whether you fail. The issue is, what do I do and what have I done with the results that I have produced? So that if you go to, I love that story that I heard not too long ago of a little boy who was walking, and you know how little boys do it? I used to do it all the time. And you take a softball and you throw it up into the air, and then you have a bat, which is often a stick, it was for us, and you swing at it like this, and the little boy throws the ball up into the air, and he swings, and he misses. So he picks the ball up again, and he walks a little further, and nobody's around, and he throws the ball up into the air, and he swings again, and the ball falls to the ground. He misses. Then he picks up the ball again, and he looks around, and nobody's there, and he throws it up into the air, and he swings his stick. It misses again and hits the floor, the ground. And he responds, "What a pitcher." It's the idea that you can never fail at anything. And I can't tell you how many endless clients that I have told, you have never failed at anything in your life. If you weigh 300 pounds, and you've weighed 300 pounds for the last 20 years, you have just produced enormous results. And the question isn't, why am I such a failure? Why have I always been obese? Why have I always been these terrible things that are back there in the past that I'm bonded to, and now coming up with reasons to explain it away? Well, my mother, you know, we have this, and then I'm doing it in response to that, and this is because of that. And you can come up with an endless number of reasons. I was talking about this last night, that my brother and I both lived in the same foster homes and the same orphanage for years. And my one brother is very shy and very reserved and has had a great deal of difficulty. And I've been out there, you know, very public and very outgoing and so on. And both of us can explain our behavior on the basis of the same experience. Obviously, I have self-confidence because I never had anybody to give me confidence when I was young. And I was always going from place to place, so I had to go within and rely upon myself. And my brother would say, obviously, I don't have any confidence because I didn't have anybody to give me any confidence when I was young. There was nobody there, so that's the way my life is. And you can explain anything away. But if you're that 300-pounder, you have produced results. The question is, what are you doing with the results that you've produced? What are you going to do about that? Are you going to be a great pitcher and remind yourself of this is a different way to look at that? Or are you going to tell yourself that my personal history is such that there's nothing I can do about it? If you want to walk the extra mile, the path less traveled, give up your personal history. If you don't have a story, you won't have to live up to it. And you can live every moment in the only place where you'll ever come to know what it's like to be connected and united with God. It's the only place God ever is or ever has been. Right here. Now. Any other thoughts? Ideas? Yes.
One of my favorite sayings is, you can't do anything about the past except learn from it.
It's a great observation. And you also want to be careful not to be bonded to it. Don't use your weaknesses, your struggles, your difficulties, the things that happen to you as a calling card. You know, sharing it with everybody else and using it as a way to get sympathy for yourself. If you've been through a divorce, if you're a widow, if you've been through cancer, if you've been whatever it is, don't use that as a way to get attention for yourself. Because what it'll do is it'll keep you bonded back here. And it'll also give you more of an opportunity to repeat and attract the very thing that you're still upset about. This next principle, number 6, came from a line by Albert Einstein when he was talking to his students about trying to solve mathematical problems and equations. He said, "You can't ever solve a problem with the same mind that created it." It's what they call sometimes in management circles thinking outside of the dots or outside of the box. Getting out of your comfort zone. Getting out of looking at things the way you've always looked at them. And having a different kind of an awareness. I came across this quote not too long ago. "Moving away the clouds does not make the sunshine." It merely reveals what was hidden all along. The sunshine, the sun is always there. And you don't make it shine by just taking things away. There's something inside all of us that is hidden. And it's the ability to, I call it rewriting our agreement with reality. It requires a new kind of awareness, a willingness, if you will, to see yourself as potentially capable of virtually anything. I've always loved the observation from the New Testament of Jesus, that even the least among you can do all that I have done and even greater things. That within each and every one of us, there is this ability to be healers. There's this ability to be able to manifest and attract anything into our lives that we put our attention on. There's this ability to live at such a high level of consciousness that we can transcend our bodies. And I've always sort of taken that line at face value. That each person, particularly as I've looked at my own self, I've never looked at the reasons why I couldn't attract something into my life. I've just never been wired together that way. So that my internal wiring has always been one of whatever it is that I've got in my life as a problem, that I have to take responsibility for it, but I also have the capacity to be able to change it. And not only to change around what it is that is not working for me, but also to change around what I have been attracting into my life. I think it begins with this whole idea of being inspired. I've always liked that word, inspired, inspiration, because its origin is in spirit. And then the opposite word is being informed. And so when you're in form, in the physical world, when you're in form, you get information. You get lots of information. And this is what we call the information age, right? So there's no shortage of information. They say that on a little chip the size of your thumbnail, we can put the names and addresses of everybody in the United States and Canada on a little chip the size of your thumbnail. That's really more information, I think, than we need. And the ability to have information. We have enough information. I mean, I had somebody come up to me and said, I checked on the internet and I put your name on there and there were 82,000 references to your name. And I said, and I don't even own a computer. And I never ever sent any information in any place. And yet someone told me there are 82,000, I don't know where they came up with that number, but 82,000 references and cross-references and this and that and in different languages and around, whatever it might be. And I have no idea. I mean, if they saw me masturbating when I was 14, I don't know if that's on there or not. It probably is now that I've mentioned it. A new update. There's somebody back in the room taking notes here. That's just, So the information age is what we are now. But what we are doing is we are moving from the age of information to the age of inspiration, I believe. And as we move into the age of inspiration, where collectively mankind is beginning to have a collective capacity to be able to think thoughts which empower us rather than which weaken us, which, according to Hawkins' research, up until about 1985 or 1986, collectively, mankind's collective thoughts always produced that which weakens us. And now, in the last few years, we have moved above the level where man's collective consciousness is at least at a place where collectively we are empowering ourselves rather than using force. And as we move into the world of inspiration, we have to understand what that means. And Patanjali had a wonderful observation. I wrote about it in Wisdom of the Ages. He said, when you are inspired, that is, in spirit, and remember, it is in the world of spirit, it is in the world of thoughts where we change, where we go to the place where we create anything we want for ourselves in our lives. So that remembering here, the theme is that you can't solve any problem that you might have in your life with the same mind that created it. So you're moving into a place now called spirit. That which is seen hath not come from that which doth appear. We're moving into the world of the invisible now. When you are inspired, and think about the moments in your life when you've had the most inspiration, inspirado. You lose any touch of fatigue. I have gone and been inspired at moments in my life when I have written for almost 24 straight hours without stopping, without eating, without thinking about sleep. I just got into one of those modes, you know, what we call a zone sometimes, where everything just flowed. When you are in that place, you transcend everything. And you don't think about, you don't worry about whether people are going to call you or not call you. You don't worry about your children. You don't worry about being sick. You don't think about the cold that you might have. You don't think about being tired and how much sleep you'll need. When you're inspired, you're in spirit. When you're in spirit, you're connected to your source. And now what you're doing is you're moving out of the mindset of inform or information, which is where all problems occur in the world of the physical, and you're shifting into the world of spirit, so that when you move into that, here's how Patanjali put it. When you are inspired by some great purpose, some extraordinary project, all of your thoughts break their bonds. Your mind transcends limitations. Your consciousness expands in every direction, and you find yourself in a new and a great and a wonderful world. And then he said something that I really love and is relevant to what we're speaking about here. He said, dormant forces, that is, forces that you thought were dead, dormant forces that weren't accessible to you, dormant forces, faculties and talents come alive. And you discover yourself to be a greater person by far than you ever dreamed yourself to be. And all of that is about something called inspiration, moving into spirit, where there are no problems. You see, there are no problems. There's no death in spirit. As Jung said, the telling question of your life is your relationship to the infinite. And infinity, or that which is never dies, is a part of the word spiritual, as I define it, in a spiritual solution to every problem. So the infinite becomes your the place where you live, your playground, if you will. And when you are in that infinite place, that place in which it is impossible for problems to occur, you are now looking at problem resolution or struggle resolution with a totally different mindset altogether. What you're looking at is how can I turn this thing over to something to which I'm always connected, which is greater than I am, but is always connected to me. How can I do that? Some call it turning it over to God. But it's almost as if you say to yourself, I don't know how to handle this. I don't know what I can do with this. I know somehow how I'm experiencing it is very painful for me. And I know that I am going to take responsibility for owning it, whatever it might be. How I feel about it is mine. I own that. But I don't know what to do about it. I'm just at a loss. It's so painful. It hurts so much. I can't see any solution. I can't get past it. So what am I going to do? I'm going to first of all say that whatever mind I used to create it, I'm not going to use to continue to try to solve it with. It's like I have a doubles partner, my buddy Lenny Solomon, for years and years and years. And when we get into a match where we're losing and where we are continuously trying to do the same thing, he will often remind me of my definition of insanity, which is to expect new results with the same behavior. And he'll say, look, we've got to change. You've got to come to the net, or we've got to go back, or we've got to start lobbing, or we've created a place where we are down and we don't have a chance to win if we keep doing this. Often I'll just say, look, they're better than we are. Especially you. But I don't want to remind him of that, because it's never me. But it's that reminder that we have now created, it's a problem, it's a minor problem, obviously it's a tennis match. But it is still, we have created this outcome, we have created this with this mindset, and we're not going to solve it with the same mindset. So we have to change. There are certain animals that Castaneda speaks about in the desert that are called power animals. And they have no natural enemies, these power animals. And the reason that they're power animals is because they never do the same thing twice or the same day. You can never predict what their behavior is going to be. They don't just always, when an eagle is overhead, they don't just run. Sometimes they might stop, they might freeze, sometimes they spit something out, sometimes they go very softly. So they are constantly altering what it is so that any predator that they might have can never figure them out. That's what you want to become, a power animal that is not predictable. If anybody tells you how predictable you are, you don't want that to be considered a compliment. Emerson said that a foolish consistency is the hobgoblin of little minds. You know, that you have to always be consistent. But Mom and my kids always say that to me all the time. Dad, yesterday you said I could, and you told Serena that we could, and then she said that you could, and you could do that. And I always say, wait a minute. Emerson said, a foolish consistency is a hobgoblin and a little mind. I don't want to be thought of as having a little mind. And that's a fool. You bought her a car, and you bought him a car, and at that you bought him a car. I said, isn't that great? Now I don't have to buy you one. Because you wouldn't want me to be a hobgoblin. You wouldn't want me to be a little mind, would you? They throw my stuff back at me, though, worse than I do on them, I promise you. But in a sense, what I'm suggesting here is the ability to change your mind and to rewrite your agreement with reality. And I'd like to help you to rewrite your agreement with reality here. I'd like to suggest to you that there is absolutely nothing that you can conceive of that you can't create for yourself in your life. The problem is whether you can conceive of it or not. That's usually the difficulty. And if you can begin to conceive of yourself as someone who has the capacity to do anything that any human being has ever done, rather than be stuck in what other human beings haven't done, it's called breaking through paradigms. You remember Roger Bannister? You know who Roger Bannister was? First person to run the mile in under 4 minutes. And for centuries, it was considered that it was impossible to run a mile under 4 minutes. Human beings couldn't run that fast. They had done calculations. They had figured it all out. And finally, after, I don't remember what year it was, but it was in the 1950s, I believe, this man in England, his doctor, went out there and he ran a mile in under 4 minutes. The next week, somebody else did it. The next week after that. And now, there are high school students who run the mile in under 4 minutes. And now they're talking about the 3-minute mile, which is, I think you'd need a Mercedes to get there, but they're talking about it because the world record in the mile is somewhere down around 3:41 or 3:42 or something like that. I'm not quite sure what it is. But it's much, much, much lower than it was a few years back. And it's breaking through those kind of paradigms that we have for ourselves in our own lives as well, about what it is that we are capable of. Remember, every limitation that you have ever placed on yourself in your life about what you can or can't accomplish is the source of that being your reality. It's the belief that it's you're capable or incapable of doing it. And the willingness, the ability to shift out of that and into I like the word intention. I intend to manifest. I intend to attract into my life whatever it might be. It's an absolute fail-proof or fail-safe means for me. I absolutely intend to do it. When I put those PBS specials out there and decided that I wanted to go out there and make these into something that would help me to fulfill a destiny of using the television media as a means for raising the consciousness of this country, I had an intention. And that intention was not something that I ever listened to anybody else. And there's lots of people who consider themselves to be experts in that whole field of public television who have told me so many things about what can't be done and why it can't be done and you can't do all of it. And all of that is just something that I just let pass. I just pass when I hear that. And I maintain the intention. And what I have done is I have put together something about 8 or 9 different themes, if you will, that I want to just share with you here, very briefly on each one of them, of what it takes to create this new rewrite of your intentions in your life, or a rewriting of the agreement that you have had with reality. And I'd like to suggest that you put no limitations on what it is that you could rewrite as your intention. That is, if you believe that it's possible to fly, then make that a part of your agreement with reality. Not necessarily that you're going to do it. I always tell people who have been thinking about smoking, who've been thinking about quitting drugs, or who've been trying to change something in their life, change around your agreement with what is possible for you. See yourself. Whenever I read stories about some of these great saints who could bilocate, I start practicing bilocation, where they would talk about someone being seen in one part of the village and then another part of the village on the same day. And I don't go around bragging about it or telling other people that I'm going to do this or watch this or whatever. I just have this sort of internal, yeah, I think that it's possible to be able to do that. I think I watched people do these, what they call yogic races, where these yogis would sit down with their legs folded and sitting straight up in a meditative position, and they would bounce themselves down in that position down a runway, and there would be hurdles about 3 foot high, 36 inches high. And when they would come to one of those, they were able to lift their entire body over the hurdle and onto, and they would have races doing this. And they have taken the greatest finely tuned Olympic athletes, the gymnasts, the people who have the greatest bodies in the world, and they put them in that position with their legs folded, and they say, okay, now see how far you can lift your body doing that. And they can only get about 3 or 4 inches off the ground. And these are people who go, and I've seen it happen with my own eyes. I've watched them do it, that they have the ability to move up there, and through consciousness, through their minds, up they go. And down they, back down they go. And then they go up a little further, bounce, 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 and they come to 136 inches, over they go. It's fast! I love that! Pardon? I saw that on a video that was done up at the Chopra Center in Lexington, in Massachusetts, right? Yeah, they had a video of them doing those races right there in Massachusetts. It blew me away to see that. And I began to do the Yoga Sutras. When I heard about the Yoga Sutras, and being able to levitate, and I read Patanjali talking about teaching people to do these sutras where you repeat one, and then the second day you repeat the first one, and then the second one, and then the third day you repeat the first one and the second one, and then you repeat the third one for 15 minutes, and then the fourth day until you get up to about 35 or 40 of these, and you go through all of these sutras, and ultimately when you reach the 40th sutra and you're able to repeat each one of these sutras that that preceded it, and they have become, it's a part of your consciousness just through the repetition a process and making it a mantra that these people were able to raise their body up and go down. And I practiced that in my own office, in my own space, and was able to literally felt my body move above the ground and seemed to stay there for a few seconds, and then it would ease itself back down just by practicing those sutras. Don't place any limitations on what it is that you would like to be able to attract into your life. Remember that any limitation that you experience in your life, any limitation, is there because of a thought that you have decided is what you can't or can't do. Well, there's 8 or 9 of these, and I want to go through these, what are called principles for changing your agreement with reality. And I want to just read you this from, again, from Hawkins' brand new book, The Eye of the Eye, E-Y-E of the Eye. And the first one of these is just simply the word attitude. And this is what he says about attitude. The way of spiritual advancement through consciousness is actually uncomplicated and simple. The primary quality is really one of attitude, in that one looks at life not as a place to acquire gain, but as an opportunity for learning which abounds even in the smallest of life's details. A spiritual attitude leads one to be friendly, kind, and well-meaning to all life. We find ourselves walking over an ant carefully rather than squashing it, not as a compulsive must or a religious rule, but out of a greater awareness of the value of all life. All animals will be discovered to actually be individuals who respond to respect and attention. Even plants are aware of it when you love and admire them. That's an attitude. That's the attitude I'm speaking about here. And I watched it. I just spent some time with Franklin Levinson over on Maui at a place called Adventures in Horseback. And if you're ever on Maui, I recommend that you give him a call. Just look up Adventures in Horseback. And he's a horse whisperer himself. And we spent a day with two of my children who he was teaching them how to communicate with horses. And he said, what do most people do when they walk up to a horse for the first time? What do? We touch him on the nose, don't we? We do this to a horse. He said, if anybody ever came up to you and put their hand on your nose, what you want to do is take a different approach. And he began to show us how to communicate with a horse. And this horse, especially with that little girl, who's 11 years old, she, after a very short time, this horse was coming up, walking over to her, nuzzling her, and it was all done through this silent kind of attitude of love and respect for you, rather than I am here, because horses, as he explained, are basically used as food by mankind for as far back as we can go. And so they have an innate kind of cellular fear of mankind that you have to transcend and you have to overcome. And it's like you open yourself up to that kind of an attitude. So the first word is attitude. The second is something that, a word that I like, it's called radical humility. Radical humility. That is, it is an easing up of the ego so that you can rewrite your agreement with reality that says that who I am is not what I have and what I do and what others think of me and all of my accomplishments and all of my achievements and all of my acquisitions and so on, but that who I am is a piece of God. And as a piece of God, I am radically humble. That is, I have no need to make myself better than anybody else. I've often said that true nobility is not defined by being better than someone else. It's defined by being better than you used to be. It's just about being better than you used to be. If you've got problems in your life, very often these problems or struggles or difficulties are things that are there because of an absence of humility about who you are and your importance. If you see yourself as a piece of God, just as a piece of God. I'll never forget watching your Sai Baba in India, who was asked the question, "Are you God?" And he said, "Yes, I am." And the questioner was sort of taken aback, and he said, "And so are you." He said, "The only difference between you and I is that I know it and you doubt it." That those three magic words that U.S. Anderson wrote about in his wonderful book, Three Magic Words. And at the very end of the book, you don't find out what the three magic words are unless you read the end first, until the last paragraph. You are God. You are connected always to God. I am in you, and you are in me, and I am in the Father, and the Father is in you. And when Jesus said, "It is only through me that you will come to know the Father," he was not talking about the Spirit. He said the Spirit, the flesh counts for nothing. It's the Spirit that gives life. He wasn't talking about his body. He wasn't talking about his beard. He wasn't talking about his robe or his sandals or his physicalness. He was speaking about himself, not as a human being here having a spiritual experience, but as a spiritual being having a temporary human experience. And it was through that that you come to know the Father. And so much of our misinterpretation is why over a billion people have been slaughtered in the name of Jesus. Because we interpreted that comment to mean it is only through the body, the flesh, when he never spoke of the flesh. The flesh counts for nothing. Those were his words, not mine. The third is the ability to give love. The ability to give love. If you want to become a person who changes your mind and rewrites your agreement with reality, the ability to give it rather than to seek it. The fourth is an absence of judgment. To see if you can cultivate an attitude in your life in which you understand that when you judge another person, you do not define them. You define yourself as someone who needs to judge. You define yourself. You do not get to define me by calling me a fool, by calling me stupid, by calling me ignorant, by calling me anything. That is just something that you define in yourself. That the absence of judgment, or the ability to suspend the judgment and rewrite your agreement from a non-judgmental way, will teach you how to resolve problems almost instantaneously. Most of your problems in relationships come from your willingness, your unwillingness, to let go of judgment. The next is giving up guilt. Guilt is nothing more than an attempt to manipulate the past and to make yourself feel less than whole because of anything that you might have done that you feel sorry about. Guilt, I've called in your erroneous zones 30 years ago, I called it a wasted emotion. Because feeling guilty about something can only take place in the present. Now, if you do something that you don't like and you'd like to make amends about it, by all means do so. And if you do something that is wrong or unfortunate, or that you feel some shame about whatever, by all means make amends, and by all means work at not doing it again. But feeling guilty does nothing more than mean to have you using up the present moment, being immobilized in the present over something that already has taken place. And again, the past is the past. I used to use the example of the Peloponnesian War. If all of us in this room were to sit here and feel guilty about the outcome of the Peloponnesian War and the way the Spartans were treated versus the Athenians or whatever it was, then could we change the outcome of the Peloponnesian War with our guilt? And then I would remind people that what happened 20 minutes ago is just as over as the Peloponnesian War. It's just as over. The next is called willingness, and it's probably the most important key. Willingness means I open myself up to the potential or the possibility of being able to create a problem-free life. Willingness is that whole idea of the first principle. I have a mind that's open to everything and attached to nothing. The idea that I will say to myself, these are the conditions in my life that I dislike, and I am willing to create an intention to change them. Willingness. And the next is letting go of resistance. Letting go of any resistance that you might feel. Most of your resistance to creating a world or a life in which you no longer are attracting the same kind of problems you have is rooted in other people's conditioning processes that you have bought into. Whether it's the conditioning process of the groups that you're a part of, or the family that you're a part of, or the cultural experiences that you've been told are the only way that you can behave or look at a problem. Letting go of all of that. Just, there's no resistance. I open myself up through meditation to be free from resistance. No resistance. And when you do, as they say in Sanskrit, when the student is ready, when you're really ready, readiness and willingness are the same. When you're ready and willing, whatever teachers you need will be there. They'll show up and it works. It's a universal principle. And when Jesus said, it is only through me that you will come to know the Father, he was not talking about the Spirit. He said the Spirit, the flesh counts for nothing. It's the Spirit that gives life. He wasn't talking about his body. He wasn't talking about his beard. He wasn't talking about his robe or his sandals or his physicalness. He was speaking about himself, not as a human being here having a spiritual experience, but as a spiritual being having a temporary human experience. And it was through that that you come to know the Father. And so much of our misinterpretation is why over a billion people have been slaughtered in the name of Jesus. Because we interpreted that comment to mean it is only through the body, the flesh, when he never spoke of the flesh. The flesh counts for nothing. Those were his words, not mine. The third is the ability to give love. The ability to give love. If you want to become a person who changes your mind and rewrites your agreement with reality, the ability to give it rather than to seek it. The fourth is an absence of judgment. To see if you can cultivate an attitude in your life in which you understand that when you judge another person, you do not define them. You define yourself as someone who needs to judge. You define yourself. You do not get to define me by calling me a fool, by calling me stupid, by calling me ignorant, by calling me anything. That is just something that you define in yourself. That the absence of judgment or the ability to suspend the judgment and rewrite your agreement from a non-judgmental way will teach you how to resolve problems almost instantaneously. Most of your problems in relationships come from your willingness, your unwillingness to let go of judgment. The next is giving up guilt. Guilt is nothing more than an attempt to manipulate the past and to make yourself feel less than whole because of anything that you might have done that you feel sorry about. Guilt, I've called in your erroneous zones 30 years ago, I called it a wasted emotion. Because feeling guilty about something can only take place in the present. Now, if you do something that you don't like and you'd like to make amends about it, by all means do so. And if you do something that is wrong or unfortunate or that you feel some shame about whatever, by all means make amends and by all means work at not doing it again. But feeling guilty does nothing more than mean to have you using up the present moment, being immobilized in the present over something that already has taken place. And again, the past is the past. I used to use the example of the Peloponnesian War. If all of us in this room were to sit here and feel guilty about the outcome of the Peloponnesian War and the way the Spartans were treated versus the Athenians or whatever it was, then could we change the outcome of the Peloponnesian War with our guilt? And then I would remind people that what happened 20 minutes ago is just as over as the Peloponnesian War. It's just as over. The next is called willingness, and it's probably the most important key. Willingness means I open myself up to the potential or the possibility of being able to create a problem-free life. Willingness is that whole idea of the first principle. I have a mind that's open to everything and attached to nothing. The idea that I will say to myself, these are the conditions in my life that I dislike, and I am willing to create an intention to change them. Willingness. And the next is letting go of resistance. Letting go of any resistance that you might feel. Most of your resistance to creating a world or a life in which you no longer are attracting the same kind of problems you have is rooted in other people's conditioning processes that you have bought into. Whether it's the conditioning process of the groups that you're a part of, or the family that you're a part of, or the cultural experiences that you've been told are the only way that you can behave or look at a problem. Letting go of all of that. Just, there's no resistance. I open myself up through meditation to be free from resistance. No resistance. And when you do, as they say in Sanskrit, when the student is ready, when you're really ready, readiness and willingness are the same. When you're ready and willing, whatever teachers you need will be there. They'll show up and it works. It's just a universal principle.